Well, my name is Bill, and I'm an alcoholic. Some people, when they got close to this, it sounded better, and some people... Closer? Oh, here you go. Oh, this is even better because I do a leaner. And I'm an alcoholic. My home group is Came to Believe in Memphis. And I just got a... You know, my wife and I pray before any meeting, especially ones that I'm asked to speak at. We ask God's blessing on the effort and his direction. And we did so today as well, early on. And I've got one word that comes to me is gratefulness, of course. We've been to meetings where that's been the subject, and that fear of missing meetings and resentments have always been the most popular topics. But I do really feel very, very grateful. And one person whose name comes to mind a lot these last few days is my sponsor from Chicago at the time, and he was my sponsor for 17 years until he passed away in 1972. And so I really haven't had a sponsor since then. So any volunteers out there, help me, help me. But he was a wonderful man, and he was the kind of a person that most all people love to be around. He was just a great, he was like a father to me more particularly, and I like a son to him, and the son that he'd never had. And he drank himself out of his first marriage, second marriage. She had a child who unfortunately passed away when she was just 12 years old from leukemia. And it was long, long ago, I guess, probably was in the 40s that her 12-year-old daughter died. But I just can't tell you how many miracles just seem to pop up all the time. And obviously it's this fellowship. And of course, my wonderful wife, Ellie, who sits in the second row here tonight. And I've just been blessed. I have just been more than abundantly blessed over these years of being in AA. I came in New York City, and that was my home. Grew up in East Harlem in New York, and with the tenement neighborhoods and all that. And so from the earliest I can remember, drinking was always an acceptable pastime in that neighborhood. And whether noontime or mornings, people just were used to drinking. It was mostly, unfortunately, in that respect, that I'm not pointing a finger, but a lot of it was the Irish culture. So my mother and father were both immigrants from Ireland, and she worked as a hotel maid for many years. And my father, when he was working, was a longshoreman on the docks in New York. But he also spent a lot of time in and out of Rikers and the Tombs, which are two penal institutions in New York. So he's kind of a wild guy and a very abusive guy, verbally very abusive, and physically to my mother. So it was not a very happy childhood. It's what you'd probably call a broken home. That's what we called it. Now, it's not, the word dysfunctional wasn't even around at that time, but it was really a screwed up. Not only screwed up in our home, but the whole neighborhood just seemed to be on fire. So getting into drinking was a very, very early start for me. As I can remember, I lived in, by the time I was 11 years old, I lived in 9 different tenements. Some of these were cold water flats, you had a big pot belly stove in your apartment of all of things, so that was I don't think many people can just picture something like that, but that's how we lived. And I'd go down to get my father out of some of the gin mills he hung out in and try to bring him home with the last 50 cents or so in his pocket. And some of his friends would ask me to chug a lug of beer. Here I am 6 years old. And from that point on, I never realized it until just about, maybe 14, 15 years ago before I moved to Memphis. We lived down in Texas, and a young lady there in the group said, that booze really got rid of the shame that I had in my life. And And I tell you, I think that that came back to me when she's talked about that. I never identified, you know, things like shame with the alcoholism, recovering, and all that. And when I came into AA, the attitude was that, what's the difference if you fell out of the baby carriage or what? You're a drunk. And that was it. But in my case, I got to like this stuff because even at that age, it was a chance to bury some of the upheaval that was going on in my home and my house. I had a brother and a sister. He died in an alcoholic convulsion about 30 years ago now. And my sister, she's married, lives up in Connecticut. But I think that I don't want to spend a huge amount of time. You can be sure that the drunkologue was a bad one. I mean, the experiences. But also, this day and age, I can look back on some of the horrors of those yesterdays, and I think I can turn it over, I can flip it a little bit, because it was the best thing in the long run that ever happened to me. I believe you can't scare an alcoholic, though. So the trauma that I may have lived through and so forth wasn't necessarily a factor in my recovery. It was, like they said in the old days in New York, you know, you don't dwell on the past, you might reflect on it, though. And so in reflection on that past, it actually got worse after first coming to AA. And we were talking at lunch today about the description of, let's say, an open AA meeting in New York at the time, and I'm speaking of 1951, and you would always hear the chair, the secretary of the group. There were three speakers. The meeting started at 8 o'clock and went on till, I guess, 9:30 or so. But the secretary of the group would say, if you're new here, please come see me after the meeting, and I'll see if we can get you a temporary sponsor. That was the all-important thing in AA at the time, sponsorship. And also would go on to say that if you think you're an alcoholic, please understand something to that effect, but she would, or he would, enlighten the people, especially the newcomer, that if you continue to drink and you're an alcoholic, there's a good chance you'll wind up in a mental institution or jail and be unemployable and everything else. And she was absolutely right. And that AA does ruin your drinking, that's for sure. That first meeting just killed it for me. It didn't kill it so much that I wanted to escape and get into sobriety, but it sure was an enlightening factor. My sponsor, I was working at the time, and this is 1951, and I was working at the time for the Borden Milk Company in New York in the law department. I was just an office boy. Between sharpening pencils, I did other errands, going down to the courts, filing papers. And the company paid my tab to go to college at night at St. John's University, which is in Brooklyn, New York. And and also the Korean War had broken out, and I was already in a National Guard outfit that I enlisted in 3 months before Korea broke out. So I didn't know whether I had a job, whether I was heading for Korea, or whether I should still go to school, all of that. So you can see why I was a troubled alcoholic, you know, these decisions that I had to make. Some of them were being made for me, though. And I found that this man, that one of the men in this law department, was a very prominent lawyer in New York and a very highly respected guy. And he'd been later found out in AA for about 5 years. His wife, Seal, she was in the program. They came in a day apart, so 5 years, it meant they came in around 1946. Her story is in the big book, Fear of Fears. So I was really blessed. Yeah, you wonder. I mean, I can think of a lot of things that happened, even before that happened in my life, that were just miracles events that turned into absolute miracles. I mean, to be blessed with a guy and his wife, especially, I was 19 years old, and to be that young in AA and be blessed with a guy and his wife. They were like parents to me, you know. And he had asked me to begin with one day, he says, do you think he can't caught me in the law library? And he said, you think you got a problem with your drinking, Bill? And I didn't know how to answer him. After all, he was a highly respected guy. And he said, would you like to come home and have dinner with me and meet my wife? I said, sure. So I went home, had dinner with him that night or the next. I don't remember the event that closely, but I went home, and I think it probably was that night, had dinner. And afterwards, they said they wanted me to go meet some friends of theirs. And they lived up where the new General Services is headquartered on Riverside Drive in New York. And they took me to my very first AA meeting, which is called Lenox Hill in New York. That's the group name. And it still goes on, by the way, today, if any of you wind up going to New York. And Thursday nights is this open meeting. And that's a long time that place is. It's an Episcopalian church right on Fifth Avenue. And it was probably the largest meeting in New York. And so I went there, and I can't tell you exactly what my fever was or what anything specific about it. But I know that one thing I do remember about it, people seemed to be loving one another. They were happy, joyous, and free. There were maybe about 100 people in that meeting. Doc Silkworth was alive at the time, and he would come across Central Park from Towns Hospital and be at that open meeting. The irony of it all is that every time I saw him, there were usually at this open meeting, the wives of the alcoholics all glomming on. He's just a little guy, by the way, and glomming all over him, asking, you know, the usual question to him was, when's Charlie going to be able to drink again? And what am I going to tell my neighbors? You know, so I noticed once or twice he'd try to escape him, and he would come to me because I was, I guess, by far the youngest person. Some say that I was the first teenager to come into AA. That's a nice thing, but the fact is that if you were in my shoes at the time, you'd wonder, well, why me? Because frankly, most people didn't believe you were an alcoholic at anywhere near that age. You had to be 40, 50 years old starting out. You know, you had to have the training program behind you. And I just felt so uneasy going to AA meetings. And I would go to that same group also had a Monday night meeting, and I'd go there. And by the way, Bill Wilson was often at that open meeting because it was, well, the largest, first of all. And maybe 100 people, I said. But that was very large in an AA in the spectrum. So I'd go to the closed meetings, and there was one particular guy there that one of the few people I wouldn't want to tackle with in a barroom fight, you know, but he just really got on my nerves. I never knew how to cry as a kid. You know, I just didn't know how to cry. You were kind of sissified or so in my neighborhood if you cried, you know. But I remember coming home from one of those closed meetings on the Monday night at that same Lenox Hill building, that group there, and I was in tears going from that building all the way back to my neighborhood on Second Avenue in New York at the time. And, you know, I had maybe 10, 12 blocks to walk. And I really felt hurt. And not because I had the brilliance to know that AA was my last house on the block. I mean, you're still in denial in any case, no matter what age you are, after sometimes the first meeting. But I was very, very confused, very hurt, because this guy was over and over every time he saw me, he says, you're too young to be a drunk or an alcoholic, you know. I guarantee you I polished off and did much more damage than that guy ever did, but, you know, that's for another day. And so I was very hurt. And that's, by the way, to this day, I don't care who walks through the doors of an AA meeting, because personally I believe that God sent them, and him or her. And I've been in meetings where some woman came in and she had obesity and she wanted to know if they could help her there. So A nice thing about that was that nobody raised their hand and nobody suggested anything except that they would get together with her after the meeting, but in the meantime, she's welcome to sit there and stay there. So I've always liked that about AA, the fact that it has such an open heart. I had just a bit of that, well, I guess the drunkalogue, but drinking was becoming a way of life for me. It was, and this is before going to AA at 19. I'd had a number of arrests in New York for disorderly conduct, you know, fights in bars, fights even with cops, and a little damage like that went along. But it was after coming to AA and going back to that litany that we'd hear in an AA meeting that if you're an alcoholic, that this is what, you know, the idea of being in a nut house or jail or non-employal, all that, that was, you know, a major factor, but it wasn't going to keep me sober. And another guy described it better for me, made it real easy. He says, look, if you drink again, there's a guy in a blue suit, a black suit, or a white suit going to come for you. And that made it a little bit easier to understand. And eventually, some of those things began to happen. I'd never want to go back and say that guy, Morgan Ryan, by the way, hopefully I'll get to that. Somebody could raise your hand and remind me of that, because he's the guy that introduced Bill Wilson at first to the Rockefellers. He was a bit of a Park Avenue socialite kind of guy, you know, an Irish name and all that, but that didn't blend well with my kind of Irish, you know, from the old neighborhood. You know, this is a kind of aloof individual, much like maybe the Kennedys or William F. Buckley or so. They were in a different world. They just weren't common enough for us. And regardless of that guy and his attitude of discouragement and telling me, you know, I was too young to be an alcoholic, that didn't really bother me that much. As a matter of fact, I guess that probably looking back, it might very well have been an excuse to go out and get drunk again. I stayed sober for about 6 weeks from February when I first came into AA in 1951 till I guess March or whatever it is, early April of that year. And a little bit reminded, you couldn't go to an open meeting without hearing that, again, the litany of, you know, if you drink, this is what's going to happen to you. And I was well aware of those comments and the feelings, and I'd hear stories about people that might have slipped, as we call it in those days. And But it didn't have a factor. I did go out and got into lots of trouble after that, maybe because I just wasn't ready. I might add, by the way, because Silkworth he died just a few months after I first met him. He would, I was telling Milton about this at lunch today, he would come up to you, you know, your sponsor, you're always hanging out with your sponsor because you haven't seen each other maybe. In my case, I would see him pretty often because of the same job. And he would come up and you felt like you were a potted plant because he would be looking at you straight in the eye. And this, by the way, became not just Silkworth, this became, I think, a testing method in AA, because he would stare at you. Can you imagine somebody staring at you, you know? Now, I'm not the guy that did it. No, not me, it's my brother or somebody else. But, you know, he would just stare at you, and then he would, your sponsors here, he was a very good friend of my sponsors, by the way, who also dried out a number of times in Towns Hospital. My sponsor was Bill Wilson. And I didn't know that until just a few years ago when Ellie and I were up in New York and his daughter's in the program, she's in her 70s, and says, you know, Dad's first sponsor was Bill Wilson. And that triggers another memory. But anyway, he would just stare, these people would just stare at you. And what they would try to find out is, they would ask the question to your sponsor, is he ready? Here's something The Shadows or something, that TV series, you know, or Ghost Talks or whatever. And is he ready? And what he was trying to find out is whether or not you had surrendered, in which case your sponsor supposedly would know. Well, but that's the test that they had. I think it was a test, sort of an offbeat test, but to see whether a person really was going to fit, whether he was ready. And the drinking for me, though, just really got bad. I stayed in AA that time, it was about the 6 weeks or so. Then eventually I got fired from my job and was working into 1952 and so forth, still waiting to find out when I go to Fort Benning to go with the rest of the guys, except I had an alcoholic convulsion and one of the training exercises at this Army camp up in New York. And they figured there might be something wrong with that kid. So I was having a convulsion. I had alcoholic convulsions and firing a machine gun. Well, they figured I better be, I'm still trying to find out all my Army records, and Ellie and I tried, I guess, over the years, that we found out they were all in the 5th Army, which was that big fire that they had up in St. Louis. All the records got burned up, but they say they got them on microfilm. One of these days I'll get around to it. But I couldn't figure why I was being delayed and all my buddies were going overseas. And so I was really a confused, mixed-up guy, as you can see in any case. But I just went berserk, though, after that first experience with AA. I just went crazy. My drinking got much more violent. I stole a car with a guy, went over to New Jersey to see his father's grave. He and I, the car, and a quart of Fort Roses whiskey. And of course, we got bombed out, and on the way back to New York, from where we stole the car, we were stopped at the George Washington Bridge, and then next thing is I was, you know, I think 5 days or a week in the Bergen County Jail in New Jersey, waived extradition, went back to New York, and was charged with grand larceny. And it kept on getting worse along those lines, by the way. And my drinking was really out of control. I recognized, for whatever it's worth, I'm not sure with a full commitment or full understanding, I really was bad news. I was an alcoholic. My mother was forever praying for me, you know, and I was driving her crazy, and we lived in still in one of the tenements in New York. And I started using that drug Anabuse from this Dr. Fox, and she practiced in down this part of the world too, somebody said years later. She was a psychiatrist, and she was considered the first one to use, besides Rockland State experiments, she's the first one to use that as a drug for patients. So I don't know, there's about 8 or 9 of us that would go to her office and sit around the floor and take on Anabuse. And of course, I took the Anabuse. But you know, I knew that after having my experience in AA, well, as limited as it was, that I'm a little bit smarter than that. And the Anabuse pill was something that was just very large at the time, and you carried a plastic, which was really cellophane in those days, a memo to any doctor for emergency care if they found you half dead. And so I had met this girl in New York, and I figured, you know, she's a nice gal, and so what I did was the pill would last for 3 days. So I figured, you know, I'm smarter than most. At least I gave myself that credit. No one else would. But I figured if I just crack that pill in half, that's the day and a half's worth of it. I swear to God, this was the reasoning I had. So I did, and went to the party with her, didn't drink, got her home way up in the Bronx in New York, got rid of her. Her father didn't like me because he knew I was a drunk from I don't know where. But anyway, I got into a taxi cab to go back to Manhattan, which is another borough in New York, the city. And it was about almost 4 o'clock in the morning, stopped off at a bar, got a container of beer, and got into a fight with the cab driver. And I was pretty well beating him up because now I had drank, even though it was just beer. It triggered the Anabuse that was still in me. I went berserk. And the next thing I know, I'm kind of swinging away at him, and he's screaming, and he gets back in the cab, and I get in the cab, and he pulls up about a block. You ever see that picture, French Connection, where Gene Hackman is driving this vehicle underneath the elevated trains? And that's exactly where all this happened. Same place. And that picture was a long way from coming out, but he pulled up near a cop's car, and the, you know, the cops right away, in those days in New York, they just, the second or third shot was to maim or to kill. Second was maim, third is to kill you. And they're firing away at me, and I'm running down the street. You know, I guess the cab driver told them I tried to kill them or something. And anyway, I was arrested then for assault and robbery in the first degree. Now, that's two felonies. Plus, I got that one down in Manhattan for grand larceny. That's also in New York. So a three-time loser is what I was heading to be. And that's mandatory life, I think, in New York. And go up and see all my buddies from the neighborhood, from Sing Sing and the rest of them. And anyway, the two cops, the cab driver, go before the grand jury. It was a lay down. I was guilty. If they, the long and the short of it is that I got the biggest break of my life. And the prosecutor said that if I would swear on that Bible, and I'm a Catholic kid, I never held a Bible in my life, you know, but I grabbed that one, you know. And I swore that I wouldn't take a drink, and if I did get drunk again, even for a misdemeanor, I'd do an indeterminate sentence at Rockland State Hospital. If you read your big book, you see a lot of stories about Rockland State. And so I got sort of out of that one. But the guy says, and that after that very day, I went and I told the grand jurors, you know, how appreciative I was and how humble I was and everything, how thankful I was. And I got on the subway and went back to Manhattan with my lawyer, my mother, and my father, and got rid of them, told them I was going back to AA, and my mother was so happy to hear that. Got down to the AA office, walked upstairs, and didn't even say hello to anybody, walked downstairs and across the street and got smashed. And it kept on going. It didn't get any better. There were some bad incidents that happened. I'm lucky I didn't get caught, because instead of going to indeterminate sentence, I'd have had two indeterminate sentences. You know, that's even worse than getting 20 years of an indeterminate sentence. So life was out of control, obviously. I mean, I was going crazy. There were lots of other incidents. I don't want to go into all of that for you now. But I think that that the more exciting part of all this was coming back to AA. And so that first time, I think you could say I was in AA because of my job, and the second time because of a judge. And, you know, my mother crying all the time. And I came back to AA and spent another, few weeks, not even as long as the first time. And then around 53, 54 came in, and I just ping-ponged in and out. But I never went to an AA meeting. I can tell you this, I know this for certain. I never went to an AA meeting drunk. In those days, it was pretty common because there were no treatment centers to speak of in a high-priced place like maybe Towns Hospital. But, you know, the rest of us, we just had to stumble through. And you had to white knuckle it or cold turkey it or whatever. So that was kind of the way I went ping-ponged in and out of AA. But I never went to a meeting drunk. I never took it for granted either. I knew there was something powerful about AA, not just the laughing and the smile, the friendship. There was just something very powerful about AA. The one thing I could remember over and over and over again, no matter what, was like a litany, was the serenity prayer. You know, maybe that's all I could manage at that time, mentally speaking, because that really, you know, was a prayer to me, and I know it is to many of you, all of us for that matter, in the fellowship as we recite it. You know, it has meaning. And but I was just a wreck physically, and then my health started to go bad. I had what they thought was maybe a liver problem, and the doctor in the neighborhood had treated me a number of times before, but he figured that this time he really scared me. He said, "We're going to have to get you into Rockefeller Institute of Medical Research, and that's where you go in as a kind of like a test tube baby, because that it was only for people that were terminally ill or approaching terminal illness." And so they discovered esophageal varices. You know, I used to throw up blood all the time when I drank and I was drinking just about every day. And to get it out of my system, I'd throw the blood up. And I thought that's just part of growing up, you know. And so it was, physically, I was in very bad shape. I did go to Rockefeller. There's only 70 70 patients, I think, and it's like 300 doctors, and many come from all over the world. There's usually, even to this day, there's probably 2 to 3 Nobel Prize winners that are on. You don't hear a lot about Rockefeller. It's not a private, I don't think it is, but anyway, it's for serious illnesses, and usually whatever they're specializing in, liver problems. I had some of that. I did some damage there, too. And but, you know, alcoholics don't worry about those things, you know. Where's my bottle? Yeah. I mean, don't tell me about that. I know. Where's my bottle? I just want a little bit, you know, just enough to wake up. And it was going on and on like that, and it was getting worse, obviously. They say that it is a progressive illness, and in that sense, it's progressively worse, worse, and worse, and finally you just croak. And unfortunately, we see a lot of that in the newspapers today. And it was about, it rolled into 1954 and 55, 55 in April. When I was in Rockefeller, it was the end of 1954, and I came out to go home for Christmas, and I had assigned to me this really great doctor. He's from Sweden, and he said to me that he was leaving to go home for Sweden, I guess maybe for those Christmas holidays, and he says, I may never see you again. And but maybe he unloaded the Swedish prayer on me or something, but the fact was that he told me that I was dying and I might not make it, and I was supposed to come back to the hospital right after Christmas. Well, I got rid of the hospital and went out, and honest to God, that first day out, I got drunk again. I actually got a little high, maybe, or not totally smashed, but they left rubbing alcohol in my room, you know, which is, they figured only an animal would ever drink. That's the, I liked it, you know. If you, I mean, and if you could strain it through some bread, you know, or chase it with a Pepsi Cola or a Mission Orange. So I kind of drifted away from that. And in the meantime, I was already down on the Bowery in New York with hanging out with bottle gangs. You know, you get $5 for your blood from Bellevue Hospital, and then you tip on down to the great people, which is on the Bowery. And then that's a sad experience. But anyway, somehow or other, in April of 1955, it rolled around. And my mother gave me enough money to pay for the gas and electric because she worked as a hotel maid. And so it was like $15 or so in those days, and for about 2 months' worth of gas and electric. And I took the money, and you can guess what happened. And she knew that I could do things like I would do things, but not to have to live with candles for another couple of months, you know, and in the apartment, but I took the money and go and buy this bar in New York in what they call Lexington Avenue. And by the way, that there's a guy that lived next door to me in the tenements, and he worked for the Klein Edison Company, electric company in New York. And he was on the street one day, and he recognized, because this story about the cab driver and all that, it made it big time in the newspapers in New York. He recognized the cop or the cop's name. And this guy, Matty Cowley, my neighbor, knew the cop because they'd been schoolmates, I guess, at Cardinal Hayes High School up in the Bronx. And he says, there's my neighbor you were shooting at. And the cop told him, he says, the next shot is going to kill him. So, hey, you know, that's one more for the big guy. You know, miracles. But anyway, I went by Parnell's, and I see this buddy of mine. And when I was in the hospital, there was a picture in the New York News. There was the largest selling newspaper in the world. It was the New York News, Daily News. And here's this guy with two cops under each arm, you know. He's only got his BVDs on, except that he had a holster strapped to his leg. And it was, he was the Tommy Can Shoe Store Bandit in New York. And I would fight with this guy at 4 in the morning when the bar is closed. We had another thing in common. We both used Dilantin, Nembutal, and Phenobarbital because of our convulsions, you know. And we didn't give it. We were drinking on top of that stuff. And he was in the bar. He was out on bail. He later got sentenced to Sing Sing for 7.5 to 15 years. And Tommy came out of Sing Sing. I was living in the Midwest when he came back out. I was sober then. and he died of cancer of the stomach. He was just 25. So another statistic for the neighborhood. When I woke up, though, that day in April, and honestly, as backtrack as I march, I know it was like April the 7th of 55. And that is my wife's birthday, whom I didn't meet for several years after that, in another world out in Chicago, of all places. And but the irony is that that was the day, because I got back, called AA. There was something that happened, and I've really seldom told this story because there's a lot more illuminating things that have happened in my life, but this one was real. I drank all that day with this guy, Tommy Conley, and, you know, bye-bye went the money for the gas and electric, and I came home, and after more than 10, 12 hours of drinking and being in this Parnell's bar, I get home, and I wasn't drunk. I was very tired, and my mother always made me a cup of tea or a hamburger or something and put me to bed, you know. And someplace during the night, God is my judge, I can't explain it. You have to understand, New York apartments are not that big, you know. And there was, I looked in the room, in the bedroom, it was really small, I don't know how many feet this way or that way, but it was a very small bedroom. And I looked on the wall, and this is after being in a stupor for a good day and a half or whatever, and really tired. So to wake up from that, and not common, not usual, but there was something on the wall in that tenement, in that bedroom, and I don't know what it was. It was really angelic. That's all I can remember from it. It's like an angelic kind of an experience, and somehow or other, I mean, it had to be something more than I could imagine, because later that day when I woke up, I called the intergroup office in New York, and this woman answered the phone, and she says, "Is this Bill Dooner? We've been reading enough about you. Are you coming in now?" And as this woman, Mary McMahon, who is really a legend and a great friend of Bill's. And so I went to, and that's when, that meeting, by the way, I met another guy who became my sponsor. It's not that the first couple, that Seal and Mansfield, my first sponsors, that this is now, I guess, 4 years later or so. And I went to a meeting that night in this church down near Park Avenue in New York, and it was like a Monday night. And after the meeting, people would just mill around and have more coffee or donuts and grape juice or whatever. And I look, there's this giant of a guy, like, I don't know, maybe 6'5" or so, had the weight in the shoulders that went with it. And soft-spoken guys from Nashville, Tennessee. And he played football at Vanderbilt back in the late 1930s. And he looked down at me, and all he said, I was absolutely pretty much silent there because I was back to give it another shot, give it another try, you know, something powerful happened, whether it was the vision that was still cloudy that happened in the bedroom or what, or my mother's prayers, most likely. And then this guy looked down at me, and he said, "Where are you going tonight?" And I looked up at him. I mean, I hadn't looked like that. He was so tall, and I said, "I'm going with you." And he said, "Yeah." And I did. He became my sponsor. His name was Jim Gribble. And Jim was like Pied Piper. He had 7, 8 sponsees, you call them, pigeons, what they called them in those days. And I hung out, and I went to meeting after meeting, and we knew that if it was Wednesday night, we were at this meeting. If it was Thursday, we were at this meeting. And, you know, so we sobered up like a team. And we worked for $1 an hour, this other thing, and managed to survive. But I was offered a job because I was unemployable in New York. In New York, from the period of 52 to early 55, I had 21 jobs within a 24-month period, and I can still tell you most of those jobs. Yes. But a lot of them were only 3 days or a week, and I was even so embarrassed, and you had to be really embarrassed as a drunk not to go and get your 3-day paycheck that you're still owed. But I was too embarrassed, and so I let a lot of that go by. Anyway, it was it was kind of the nightmare from hell in the long run, but I was also battling through it and, you know, asking God's help. And God was just there all the time. I was run over by a bus when I was 10 years old going over the East River to go swimming. Ice pick twice in my side, slashed on my wrist by a carpet knife in a gang fight, you know, shot at. And, you know, I couldn't give you a good excuse why I was still alive. I really couldn't. I know that the people in New York were forever wondering where I was and how I was doing, and Mary McMahon, this particularly, and Bill Wilson was asking about me a number of times. And then, you know, because I think I was like the purple tree in the forest. It's the one you're going to remember. If you're a little puppy dog at an AA meeting and you're always there, that's the one they're going to remember. But I drifted to Chicago. Company came out from Chicago, interviewed us in New York, A.C. Nielsen Company, and takes you 90 days to qualify in New York from the time you came in. So from the 7th, I guess, of April until July was the 90 day. But people wanted to know what a teenager, or not, I was no longer a teenager by then, I was 20, 23. And they wanted to know, you know, more about my life or something. So I was asked to speak at a number of meetings there in New York, and that really became my priority, you know, looking back on it, because I told this guy in Chicago that I wouldn't come out then, but he had interviewed me in New York, and that's the way they worked in those days, that company. And I wanted 10 more days extension. So it was about 100 days after getting sober in New York, I go to Chicago. Hey, who's keeping time here? This thing's not, that's for sure. So I don't want to overshoot the runway. It's now 9 o'clock. No. Wrap-up time? You want to hear more of this crap? Well, just start. If you start closing your milk, for one thing, if you close your eyes a little bit, I'll take that as a signal. I don't know what time we got started. I'm sorry. But it's kind of, you know, leaving there, going to Chicago, and I'm in Chicago. I'm so happy. I beat that Commodore Vanderbilt train from Grand Central to Chicago, just, you know, $37 for fare for the one-way ticket, because this company didn't give you a round-trip ticket. It was one-way. And so I got a $37 ticket. And I saw some guys that, there was a whole bunch of people from AA that came down to the Grand Central to see me off, you know, and a lot of people from the intergroup and so forth. And whatever. But anyway, I was invited up to a club car to have drinks. Some people that were on the club car, they worked for Abercrombie and Fitch in New York, and they knew some of the people that were down there to say goodbye to me or whatever. So they invited me up on a personal invitation to go up to their car and have a drink. Little did they know. And so I said, no, I'm okay. I mean, the furthest thing from my mind was a drink. And I get to Chicago, show up at the office, and I was going to room in a rooming house in Evanston, Rogers Park is what it's called, in Chicago. I come home with these guys that I'm going to be working with, and there was about four or five other guys that were living in this place. And it was that hot July 18th, 1955, and the guy pulls out a bottle of Jim Beam from the refrigerator, puts it on a table, and to this day, some people used to, I don't hear it say as much, but there's no such thing as an unplanned slip or so. Well, I can assure you this was not planned. I was really happy in AA, but where the demons are there all the time, and this one got me. I took a drink, and it hit me so fast, so hard, that I was fired from the job. I got paid for 9 days, and I think I showed up part of 3 days. Ironically, they gave me a ticket to go back to New York, which is, as I said, really a rarity. It's good in the long run, because you could cash your tickets in those days at the station, so I did, and that 37 or whatever, plus hocking my watch. But the only place I knew that I could survive was Skid Row in Chicago, so I did. I lived there. Right on the streets, in hallways. If I had 50, it cost 50 cents a night in those days to get a flop house, to get a room, not a room, a cot. If you had 75 cents, you could get a cage. That meant you'd have your shoes in the morning because you could lock it. And Ira Hayes, the Indian that raised the flag at Iwo Jima, was on Skid Row in those days too. And his shoes were stolen from him one time. So it's not that they passed some kind of a law that no shoes in him, but the fact was that even he, as prominent, as highly regarded as he was for being one of the people that raised, Marines that raised that flag at Iwo Jima, he was just another drunk. And so surviving there, it was, I don't know, I got some nights I'd had the 50 cents, most nights I didn't. So really, it was 50,000 estimated alcoholics and drug addicts, homeless people on Skid Row in those days, West Madison Street. And one night, I had been in a bad fight somehow or other. My ear was kicked in. I had cut over the eye. I had a white T-shirt on. It was covered with blood. But I didn't look any different than most people on Skid Row. I only had a pair of slacks on, lightweight summer pants, and half sneakers, the kind of tennis shoes, I guess they call them. That's all I had in the world. And I went into this Pixley and Ailes bar, a restaurant, to get a cup of coffee, you know, the big, heavy, white china cups, you know, and you'd hear the moaning and the screaming, the sleeping and the snoring all at one place. And it was really a kind of a typical Skid Row kind of coffee shop. And I was alone, and I walked out. I couldn't hear anything out of my ear. I would go in there sometimes to get the paper napkins to put into my ear to absorb this stuff, this, like black coffee, that whatever the infection was. And I couldn't hear. And I went across the street to go back to the flop house. And when I got to the corner of this LaSalle and Van Buren and Cigarette and underneath the elevated trains again, and to go across the street, a man walked up beside me or was standing there, whichever way you want to pick it, I don't know, but he was there. And it was raining too, not heavy, but a drizzly rain. He's a priest. And it's about midnight, and he walked up beside me or stood there and smiling, you know, smiling in the rain and the rain. And I asked him a crazy question. It stays crazy until you find some of the parables as well as some of the expert teachings from Jesus in the Bible, in which case you find that whenever somebody, usually the sinner, and in some cases people just infirmed mentally or physically, or in case of blindness, the miracles happen, and then it was suggested to them and they were told of them to do something afterwards, you know. And I asked this here priest, whom I'd never seen before in my life, where can I go to get my ear fixed? And he told me to go to the St. Columbus Hospital in Chicago there. So I did. I went upstairs, got on the elevated train. He told me where it was, and I go there. And I come back, and I woke up in the flop house the next morning, August the 18th of 1955. I've never touched a drop of anything since that day. Not even a thimbleful of beer. It's just a miracle happened. And we were, you know, I worked over in Chicago Avenue near Montgomery Ward at that time, and as a day laborer, you know, a shape up, you go there 7 o'clock in the morning, you and you. And this little Jewish guy, Schwartzy, would hire me because I was one, I'm not sure I'd be the youngest in that crowd. I think I was, but anyway. And he would pick me for a day's labor. It was $1 an hour, so you got $8 for 8 hours, less the taxes they took out. And he told me to go over to Catholic Charities to get some clothes. So I went over to this Holy Cross Mission in Chicago where Catholic Charities was, and I'd see the priest that I'd seen, you know, three nights or so before. And it was just a powerful experience. That priest, by the way, celebrated 50 years as a priest in 1986. And almost all his years as a priest, he, out of those 50 years, over 47 of them were on Skid Row. He was known as the Skid Row priest in Chicago. And even though he's been dead now for almost 10 years, they still refer to him as the Skid Row Father McDermott, Ignatius McDermott. There was a time, you know, when we were up there in 86, Ellie and I went to, the celebration mass for him, this guy was multicultural. The guy that was the chairman of his 50th anniversary as a priest was a guy named Abe Lincoln Maravitz. Maravitz was a federal judge in Chicago, and they had been boyhood friends from years back. Father Mack never knew whether you were Catholic, Protestant, young, old, or what. It didn't make any difference. He really was the Mother Teresa in many ways of that day and age. But there was a building, he wanted to know, he was really concerned at his age and the little bit he would get for his retirement fund and all that, what could be done to continue to help people, and especially in Skid Row. And then they would, you know, if you're in Chicago and it's the winter time, your chances of making it through the night if you're outside, which is still the case. You got to understand the Skid Row, the single room occupants, the flop house, many of them are gone because they built housing, they built the Dan Ryan Expressway, all that stuff. So a lot of that got gutted away. So today, women, for instance, a lot of women are freezing to death because it's so cold in the winter, and the wind that comes in off the lake is torturous. And so they sleep near these buildings behind bushes where the vents are for the building, the heating vents, and try to survive another night, you know. So we were able to help them get a building in Chicago, and it's got 540 beds in the place called at McDermott Center, and we also have a facility there for girls who are crack addicted. And they're sending them all 14, 15 years old themselves. And so they come in there. It's had over 900 babies born there. And there's less than three babies out of that. What the percentile is, you'll figure it out. But that have had any symptoms of crack addiction. So we have room for 40 girls at a time. And we have a little nursery there. We've got a daycare center there. And Father Mack is long since gone, but this was his hope. There's a meal for 24 hours a day. There's a detox center in the building as well. And it was our way of saying thanks to a tremendous guy. We weren't the only ones in the support of this. It was like almost an all Chicago thing. It was people from all walks of life that contributed to this. It's an 8-story building and all that. So he's still very much alive. As a matter of fact, in my wallet, I have his picture. I think that's pretty much it. One thing I must share with you is that coming off Skid Row and all that and getting right back into AA, and I meet this tremendous guy in Chicago, becomes my sponsor. And he'd never had children. It was his second marriage. I think I already said that at the outset here, George Shields. He was a senior warden, by the way, of St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Chicago. He was also the number 8th member in the Medina Temple and Masonry in Chicago. So he was a very, very, very well-respected man in Chicago. And he, became my father that I'd really never known before. And I think that it's like his son. And over the years, God had blessed Ellie and I and our 5 fantastic children with a lot of grace, a lot of love, and a lot of happiness. And they've all been well-educated. They're in business, teaching, international business in the Middle East, all sorts of things. Actually, one of our sons is down in Texas. He's a retina surgeon, you know, and he is considered one of the top doctors in Texas. And that's another world, that retina work. And anyway, you know, we've just been blessed. And the miracle just goes on. The last part of my drinking in New York, because I was even barred out of the place on 3rd Avenue, Lexington, all the Irish bars barred me, because I was trouble. So the only place I could drink was on the waterfront in New York. And so I get down there, and they didn't care whether you were a troublemaker or not. They just throw you in the river if you give them any grief. And I would get down there, and I would drink. And I would always come in, and there'd be maybe just 2 old rummies in the place that were there talking and moaning to one another. filthy bars, if you can imagine. And I would order a glass of beer, and I'd take the beer, and this was even prior to winding up in Rockefeller. So I would drink the glass of beer, and I'd take a couple of sips, because then I'd really have to go to the, if you want to call it the men's room, and I'd go in there and just throw up blood. Then I'd come back to the bar, and I'd say, I'm ready now, you know. And then the gin, straight gin, would come up to the bar, and I'd start waffling away at that all day long. But in the meantime, I would have my head, and it was in that place, those places, more than one occasion, because it was repetitive, this dream that I had, that one day I would like to be away from alcohol, that it wouldn't have this tremendous compulsion on me, that I'd lose the compulsion to drink, that I'd be away from New York. I mean, I had a lot of happiness and a lot of training ground for me, but it was bad memories too. I wanted to be away from, I wanted to be living in the country. They didn't happen in this order. I wanted to be living in the country. I wanted to be married to a wonderful girl that came from a good home, not some broken up, screwed up home that I was, that was the commonality in my neighborhoods that I grew up in. I wanted to be in the world of advertising and selling, because I got fired from a lot of jobs in that world. And I liked the idea of selling and advertising, being creative and all. I wanted to be a millionaire by the time I was 35, you know. I wanted to be respected in my community, you know, and all of that. And the irony of all this is that every one of those things happened within about 10 years. Before I was 35, in any case. And I was even asked to run for Congress in Springfield, Illinois, in the toughest, as a Democrat, in the toughest Republican district in America. And, but a lot of it had to do, maybe there was a notoriety, and I was a little afraid because of the fact that, you know, they're gonna bring up that sheet and all of that stuff, and in the papers about being a drunk and a crazy man and all that. And I'm in Chicago in 1958, in May 1958, and I had a blind date, and so the guy was supposed to show up, he didn't show up, so I go to just meet my blind date, and it's Ellie. And we met in May of 58, we got married in June of 59. Now you gotta figure that God, you wanna, sometimes you gotta say, you know, it's like we always say, is God real, is he really there? Well, I'd ask myself maybe something like that. And I said, well, I'm an Irish Catholic from New York City, and the only church that I went to go to confession was a Puerto Rican church where they didn't understand English and I didn't understand Spanish. So I could go out and do whatever I wanted and get the absolution. That place, by the way, that church is Holy Agony is the name of it. Holy Agony. And so I meet this wonderful girl from Illinois, from a farm in Illinois. And on top of that, all of this rap sheet and everything else I've already told you about, I meet this precious, wonderful girl who's a Mennonite from a farm in Illinois. Now, God's got a sense of humor, you know that. You know? And I got to tell you, this is the love of my life. We've been married now almost 55 years. And she's the greatest, and I think that God led me very much to a spiritual understanding, and I think that Ellie led me to a personal relationship with Christ, and that the first time I think perhaps I've ever gone into that depth, because I do respect the idea that it's a spiritual but not religious. But for me, hey, at this point in my life, I'm 82 now, so I think I better give God a special hand. So I'm going to tell you, that's the we did live on a lake and all that stuff, and did have all these kids, and then get into an advertising and stuff. But mostly billboard companies around the country that we've had. So we've had other businesses as well, and 32 or 42 different companies that we've had over the years, and I can't outgive God, you know. I just, maybe this is the way of, in some way, of saying thank you to him, saying thank you to my God, my Lord, you know. I'm here. And it's doing me a lot of good. I hope it's been of some help to you too. I would like to, but I didn't get into it, I don't want to take the time if anyone wants to. Bill Wilson, the stories you hear about it, Bill was a tremendous guy and a very humble guy. Didn't chase broads, and if he did, the proof of that is that all of his cliques and friendships and tightness was with the Ivy League crowd of New York, the bankers and Wall Street. The most powerful man in America was named John D. Rockefeller. He personally gave his assist and his opinion to Bill. If Bill Wilson had ever disobeyed the Rockefellers and said, I don't need them, I'm going to go out and do a public package for this wonderful thing for treatment centers, he would have been frozen out from, imagine now, that you disrespected somebody who you asked for his opinion. And you would get, there is nobody in America, and there hasn't been in recent years anybody that had the power, the awareness and the respect, to some extent respect, for John D. Rockefeller, unless you were one of his opponents. But the fact is, Bill Gates and Buffett and so forth couldn't compare with him at all, not in that day and age. That was power. I mean, the most powerful man in America is giving you an opinion. You do not disrespect that opinion and go chasing girls or doing anything. The kind of crap that sometimes I hear about in A, along with other kinds of crap called profanity. It's just sickening. But anyway, that's a negative proof, but it is a proof. I know I was there, and at that time, no one said, I'm not going to listen to Rockefeller. You just didn't. Because all of those guys in that Ivy League clique and the bankers and so would dump you like a hot potato. Bill couldn't afford that and wouldn't. So take that back with you. I'm so glad to be here. I'm so glad that Milton and Dirk called me and invited me to be here. This has really been a special blessing. This last show, I've been thinking of George Shields, that sponsor of mine in Chicago. And I've had three wonderful sponsors along the way, and my real sponsors in heaven, all of them for that matter. One is called God, and the others are my three human sponsors, and especially the Lord. Thank you so much. I appreciate much being here.